From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. As the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, Arun Gandhi learned the virtues of nonviolence and peacemaking from a master. But those lessons were tested early. Arun Gandhi grew up in apartheid South Africa, where he says he was beaten by black South Africans for being too white and by white South Africans for being too black. He admits his first instinct was to strike back, but his parents and grandparents reinforced that justice is not the same as revenge, and he eventually learned to love and understand. Today on the program, Arun Gandhi joins me to talk about living the philosophy of nonviolence. Plus, figuring out how the universe works, from the tiniest particles to black holes. The celebrated physicist Brian Greene will be in studio explaining the theory of everything. All that on Leap Day after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Throughout his numerous lectures and extensive writings, Arun Gandhi advises people to be the change they want to see in the world. And for decades, he's practiced what he preaches. He and his late wife, Sunanda, rescued and found homes for almost 130 abandoned children in India. They developed programs that transformed the economic landscape for thousands living in poverty. In 2008, Arun Gandhi launched the Gandhi Worldwide Education Institute to promote community building programs throughout the world. And today on the program, we're talking about Arun Gandhi's life, about breaking the cycle of poverty and embracing the philosophy of nonviolence. Arun Gandhi joins me. He is the grandson of Mohandas Gandhi, of course, the legendary nonviolent advocate. He wrote as a journalist for the India Times for over 30 years. Today he writes for the Washington Post blog on faith, and he's in town speaking at a couple of locations. We'll give you the details on that as we go. But Arun Gandhi, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Later on in the program, we're talking about the secrets of the universe with the physicist Brian Greene. But first, nonviolence. If you have questions or comments for Arun Gandhi about alleviating poverty or living by nonviolent principles, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Arun Gandhi, what memories do you have of your famous grandfather, Mohandas Gandhi?
Well, I lived with him at the age of 12. I went there at 12 and I lived with him for about 2 years. And he taught me many wonderful things. And I think one of the most important lessons that he taught me was about understanding the anger that I felt because of the prejudices I suffered in South Africa, and being able to channel that anger into constructive action rather than abuse the anger and cause death and destruction.
You've written a lot about anger management and understanding the anger. What have you learned?
Well, I've learned from, you know, in modern times, we talk about suppressing anger and we talk about denying it and not showing it and all that. And I think that's all negative. I think anger is a very powerful emotion. It's a very good emotion. What we need to be ashamed of is the way we abuse it. And so we need to learn how to channel that anger into positive action and create a better society. So
you followed your grandfather's footsteps. You've devoted your entire life to living the principles that he taught about correcting injustice through nonviolence, about finding peace, alleviating poverty. Why did you adopt these values as your own and dedicate your life to these principles?
Well, I saw this being practiced by my parents. My father, who was his second son, was the only one of the four sons who had devoted his life to his father's principles. And they practiced it at home as well as outside in the community and tried to build a good community in South Africa. So it was kind of ingrained in us children, my two sisters and I, seeing this being done every day by our parents. And so I think we just automatically followed in those footsteps.
It's It's interesting that you say that you saw this practiced in your home. A lot of people can say that they believe in nonviolence and peace, but when they go to the home, that's where it it really counts and really Indeed. Shows where the values are.
Indeed, that's where we start planting the first seeds of violence, the way we treat our children. When we punish our children for misbehaving, we are planting the seeds of violence there. And that is what I keep saying everywhere, that we need to change this culture of violence that we have created around us and transform it into a culture of nonviolence. And it begins at home. We have to not punish children for misbehaving, but we have to do penance. And that's what my parents did. When we misbehaved at home, they fasted and would feed us and sit at the dining table and explain to us why they were not eating, because they were not good parents and they didn't teach us the right way of behaving. And so they took the responsibility. But because the relationship between the parents and the children was based on mutual respect and love, we felt awful when that kind of thing happened, and we made sure that it didn't happen again. But if the relationship is not very good, then a child can just shrug his or her shoulders and say, well, that's up to you. You don't want to eat, I don't care. And so, you know, everything is linked in this philosophy, that we have to have good relationships with people. We have to have loving and respectful understanding of people. And so, you know, all of these things need to be. And that is why I disagree with scholars who claim that nonviolence is simply a strategy of convenience, that we use it in a moment of crisis just as we would use any weapon. And I don't agree with that. I don't think that you can be nonviolent at one moment and violent at the next moment. You have to either believe in the in the philosophy and incorporate it in your life, or you don't practice it. Just as violence, we practice violence because we believe in the philosophy and we have made it a part of our life through indirect means. We get angry, we retaliate, you know, we use violence very quickly, whether it's verbal violence or physical violence. We use it in every moment of conflict or crisis. So we made violence as a part of our life, and that's why it's become so easy for us to practice it. So we've got to change that and make nonviolence a part of our life, so that we can then find nonviolent solutions to crisis when they occur.
We're speaking with Arun Gandhi. He is speaking today at noon at Salt Lake Community College, the Taylorsville Redwood campus. He's also speaking tonight at 7 here in the main City Library Auditorium in Salt Lake City on Library Square. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments for Arun Gandhi about nonviolence and the philosophy of living nonviolence, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Back to this idea of, you know, how violence pervades every aspect of our society. You've written that justice should mean reformation and not revenge. Could you expand on that? I mean, what is a just punishment when people do things wrong?
Well, when people do things wrong, we have to look at why they were motivated to do things wrong. People don't get up one day and say, I'm going to steal something, or I'm going to beat up somebody or something. There are reasons why people are motivated to do this. And unfortunately, in our society, we are so fast-paced that we don't have time to look at all these problems. So we just catch the person, which is the easiest thing to do, catch the person who has committed the infraction, and put them into prison, or try them and punish them and be done with it. And the problem keeps festering. And so we need to, in our justice system, we need to look at the problem and address the problem instead of just punishing the people. And I feel that, you know, I'm not saying that we don't need prisons. We would need prisons until we are able to create a perfect society. But a prison should not be a place for punishment where we send them and lock the keys, lock the doors and throw the keys away there and let them languish there. Prisons should be places where we educate them and reform them and bring them out from there as good citizens. But instead, what we do today is we provide them with a very good law library and a very good gymnasium. And so the prisoners spend half the day in the law library trying to find loopholes, and the other half of the day in the gymnasium pumping iron and becoming stronger criminals. Mm. And they just come out from there being stronger criminals. And I did some work in the prisons in the past. And all of the prisoners, the first thing they told me is, you want us to change, but society has already condemned us. And even if we change and become better human beings, they are not going to accept us anymore. Mm. So why should we change? And I told them, I said, you're not changing for society. You're changing because you are a human being and you come to the realization that you want to be a better person. Not because society wants you to be a better person, because you want to be a better person.
I mentioned in my introduction that you and your late wife, Sunanda, rescued 123 infants who had literally been thrown away in the garbage cans outside Mumbai, India. How did you find out about this tragedy? And, you know, talk about the process of deciding to do something about it.
Well, this unfortunately still goes on. I go to India every year. I take a Gandhi legacy tour to India to show how people practice nonviolence in everyday life. It's a two-week tour. You know, I see every day when I go there in newspapers, a newborn baby has been found near the garbage heap. And what happens is, you know, in India, in the Indian culture, it's still a tremendous stigma for a woman to have a baby before marriage. And so they get into trouble and they have this baby and they quietly deliver the baby and then abandon it somewhere or the other. Now orphanages in India are coming up with the idea of anonymous donors. They have a cradle outside and people can come and leave the baby in the cradle and nobody asks any questions. But still, you know, these are a few places and people don't have the facility to go to them, and so they just leave them on the sidewalk somewhere hoping that somebody will find them or, you know, whatever. And that's how we saw these babies. I was a journalist and I saw this, and I spoke with my wife about it, and we were very moved by it, and so we got involved in trying to find homes for these babies. And over the years, we found homes for nearly 130 babies.
Mm. We're speaking with Arun Gandhi. He's speaking today at noon at Salt Lake Community College, the Taylorsville Redwood campus, also tonight at 7 o'clock here at the Maine City Library. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And let's go to the phones, and Henry is joining us from Salt Lake City. Henry, hi.
Hi, thank you. I have a very tough question here. In the guest example where he talks about being at a dinner table and parents fasting and an example of a child at some point saying, I don't care, because a relationship hasn't been established, what is your guest's insight in terms of what parents can then do because relationship hasn't been established? How do we get there now?
Okay, it's a good question, Henry. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, we have to begin with trying to rebuild the relationship. For whatever reason, the relationship wasn't established there. We have to change that and rebuild the relationship with the children so that they get the confidence that we truly are their parents and love them, and we do whatever we do for their good. And you know, have to have that kind of a trusting relationship. And this is an effort that we have to make to build that kind of a relationship.
Henry, it sounds like it takes some discipline, too.
It does.
Yes.
Does that answer your question?
Oh, that does. Thank you so much.
Henry, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We're talking about nonviolence with Arun Gandhi. He's the grandson of the legendary leader Mohandas Gandhi, as well as a prolific writer and activist in his own right. Arun Gandhi will speak today at noon at the Salt Lake Community College's Taylorsville Redwood campus. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he'll be here at the Main City Library Auditorium in Salt Lake City. And there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments for Arun Gandhi about his grandfather or the nonviolent philosophy, give us a call, 801-355-TALK. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Following in his famous grandfather's footsteps, Arun Gandhi talks about ethical leadership, nonviolence, and ways to fight poverty to anyone who will listen. An accomplished writer and activist in his own right, Arun Gandhi returns to Salt Lake City this week to discuss how nonviolence relates to a greater interfaith dialogue. He joins me in studio now. Arun Gandhi is with us. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You've been blogging for the Washington Post about faith issues for several years now, and you've written a few entries that are observations about the role of religion in politics and how religion has been used on the campaign trail. In one of your entries, you ask the question, are religious issues in danger of being exploited? And I'm interested in how you would answer that question.
Yes, they are being exploited, and we see this every day, and especially now in the campaigns that are going on for election, we see people exploiting religious views all the time. And what I believe and what my grandfather believed about religion is that it is part of life. And what religion ought to do is to help us become better human beings, help us understand our spiritual inner self, and also help us build better relationships with everybody. Religion is a uniting force. It's not a dividing force. Religion brings love into people, love and respect, and religion teaches us to accept everybody as every form of life as produced by God.
And yet you write that it's sad that the misuse and exploitation of our faiths has made it impossible for good people to aspire to high political offices. Is that a new phenomenon that you're seeing here, or has this been going on for generations?
No, it's been going on for a long time, but it's increasing. Every time I see this, it's just it keeps escalating and getting to a new level. I think if I can remember back 20 years ago, religion was not so much in politics as it is today. And it's creeping more and more into politics. And people now in the United States, which is the most advanced country in every sense of the word, can't imagine having a non-Christian president or, being so fussy about the person's beliefs. I mean, why should it matter? Why should it matter? I am born a Hindu, but I'm not a practicing Hindu because my grandfather believed that Hinduism has the liberal idea of allowing people to worship in whichever way they want to. And so we worship by incorporating the prayers of all the religions in our prayer services. In that way, we show respect for all religions of the world. And that's how I've grown up. So I respect Christians, I respect Muslims, I respect Hindus, I respect every religion, and I am comfortable there because all of them, these divisions are created by human beings. But basically, we are all children of God, and we are all trying to find the ultimate truth there. So if we have that kind of an open mind, why should it matter if I want to stand for president of the United States? Why should I have to be a Christian?
The religious test question. We're speaking with Arun Gandhi. He's speaking at a couple of locations in Salt Lake City today. We'll give you more information on that as we go. But if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. And we'll go back to the phones. Samer is joining us from Salt Lake City. Samer, hi.
Hello. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Maybe if you can shed some light on comparisons and maybe similarities and differences between the non-violent school of thought and current events in the Middle East, like in Syria and Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, at least from the people's side, the non-violence that I speak of, and maybe shed some light on any differences or similarities.
Okay. Sam, thanks very much for the call. Arun Gandhi.
Well, it's a very sad situation there, but one of the first things that comes to my mind is the experiment in Egypt where the young people got together and they used the technology to bring people out into the square in millions so that they could make a difference there. But the problem there, as I see it, is they used nonviolence as a weapon. And not believing in it. They just used it as a weapon. So what they did was they addressed the immediate issue, and the immediate issue for them was to get rid of the administration altogether because they were the oppressors. But they didn't have an alternate plan. It's fine to get rid of somebody or to be opposed to something, but what are we for and what do we want to create in its place? We've got to have that plan also, and that is part of nonviolent strategy that my grandfather practiced in India. That when he was opposed to something, he made clear what he was for, and when he was able to remove that administration, what he was going to replace it with. And so one, you know, people get motivated to join because then they know what we are going to create in its place. But when we just destroy something and then we don't know what's to happen, then we face the situation as we do in Egypt now. Their revolution was very successful nonviolently in getting rid of Sadat, but now they are in a dilemma because they don't know what to do. So, you know, nonviolence has to be understood properly. It has to be practiced properly, incorporated in your attitude, in your life, and then practiced in a true sense.
So it starts with the individual.
It starts with the individual. Because if the individual doesn't change, nothing changes.
For people out there, I mean, you often advise them to be the change that mm-hmm. they want to see in the world. How do you get started? What advice would you give to someone who wants to be that change?
Well, I would say that they have to, you know, be committed to the change. They have to, first of all, do introspection, which I had to do to find out how I practice violence in many different ways. You know, we have to understand that violence occurs in societies not only in the physical form, but also in the passive form. And all of us are responsible for the passive violence that we commit all the time. And the passive violence has many, many different forms. You know, some of the most popular are the discrimination, oppression, suppression, economic, political, social. The existence of poverty. Today, half of the world's population live in poverty, and poverty is the worst form of violence. And as long as we accept that poverty and do nothing about it, we are being part of the violent culture there. So we have to do that introspection, try to change those weaknesses in our character and make them the strengths and become a better human being. And then, you know, use our compassion and love and respect for society to address the problems that we can address and do whatever we can to change the society. And, you know, change then happens and many people get involved in it and it snowballs into it. So this is how an individual, you know, it's like you said earlier that you're learning things every day. And I think that's how it should be. We must keep an open mind so that we can learn from every human being that we meet and every experience that we have during the day. We are always learning. Learning never stops. It stops only when we die. And it's only through learning that we enhance our own thinking and become better human beings. So, like my grandfather used to say to me, that every morning when I get up, the first thing I should do is to mentally make up my mind that today I am going to be a better human being than I was yesterday. And then practice that.
Arun Gandhi. He's the grandson of Mohandas Gandhi. He's a journalist, a writer for the Washington Post blog on faith. He's also president of Gandhi Worldwide Education Institute. He's speaking today at noon at the Salt Lake Community College Taylorsville Redwood campus. Also, he'll be here tonight at 7 o'clock in the main City Library Auditorium in Salt Lake City. There's more information on both events on our website, kcpw.org. Arun Gandhi, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Coming up next, we're switching from philosophy to science. We're going to be talking about redefining space-time and reality as we know it, checking in on modern physics with Brian Green. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. The physicist Brian Green not only understands the complexities and the math behind string theory and multiverses, but he translates those mysteries for the rest of us. Green is a leader among a new generation of physicists who are exploring ideas about space and time and why sharing science stories matters. Dr. Green is in town to deliver the keynote lecture in the Nature of Things series presented by the Natural History Museum of Utah, and he joins me now in studio. Dr. Green, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Brian Green is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. He's the best-selling author of numerous books, including The Elegant Universe, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, The Fabric of the Cosmos, The Hidden Reality. And again, he'll be speaking tonight at Kingsbury Hall. We have a few limited number of tickets to give to KCPW members. If you want them, you can give us a call at 801-359-5279. But if you have questions for Dr. Green, you can join us now. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. He'll be lecturing about why science matters tonight at 7 at Kingsbury Hall. Dr. Green, before we get to the deep stuff, you've written some best-selling books targeting a general audience. Your first book, as I mentioned, was nominated for the a Pulitzer Prize. You've written a children's book, sort of a modern physicist take on Icarus. You've had TV shows. Why try to make these extremely complicated ideas accessible to every man?
Well, I'd say there are two reasons. One is a down-to-earth reason. When we look at the challenges that we face and the opportunities that we have across the board, from issues with nanotechnology, nuclear proliferation, the possibilities of space travel, the ability of technology to rapidly change our lives, genetically modify foods, and so on. It's all scientific at its base, and we have so many decisions to make going forward. And how can we make decisions if we don't engage with the science? So my view is the health of democracy relies upon a public that is willing to engage with scientific ideas, or else we cede all of the critical decisions to a few people who may or may not actually know what really is at the core scientifically. So that's one reason. But frankly, the reason that really fires me up is when I talk to kids or I talk to adults that have lost contact with science, and I explore with them the wonders of black holes and cosmology and the nature of time and quantum physics. And when those people turn to me and say, holy smokes, that's science? And it changes the way they engage with the world because all of a sudden the wonders of the universe are available to them. To me, that's thrilling, and I think it is a crime if anyone does not have the ability, the capacity, the opportunity to engage with these wondrous ideas.
Hmm. You had an affinity for math pretty much from birth. I've read that even at age 6, you were doing some real complicated multiplication problems. How did your teachers and your parents encourage this interest and your abilities in math?
Well, it was a little tough. I went to public school in New York, and that was back in the 60s when it was pretty rough. Most of the time in school, it was spent trying to keep the kids from fighting each other and beating each other up. So there wasn't a lot of opportunity there, although there were a few key teachers, and I think that's all that it takes, who would give me additional work to do and look at the calculations that I had done. And one teacher in particular wrote a little note for me, and he said, look, take this to Columbia University uptown. So I was a little kid, I was sort of in seventh grade, and I went with my sister up to Columbia University. We started knocking on doors, and I'd hand people randomly this note. I didn't really know what it said, but finally, you know, most people would sort of shut the door after reading it, but one person took it and said, okay, I will meet with you, because the note basically said, can you teach this kid some stuff? So this one generous graduate student met with me many times a week over many years and taught me mathematics that I would never have learned otherwise. So I was very fortunate, lucky that way.
Why physics? Why did that just capture your imagination in a way that nothing else had?
Well, as I'm saying, it did start with mathematics, but mathematics is this interesting game almost when you're a kid. You can manipulate the numbers and do calculations and things of that sort. But when I then learned that those calculations could actually tell you something about the real world, they could make predictions for what should happen out there. That, to me, was a thrilling moment, and I was hooked on physics for good when I recognized that math was this tool for describing reality.
We're speaking with the physicist Brian Greene. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And let's go to the phones. Jesus is joining us from Salt Lake. Jesus, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
I have a question for Dr. Greene. I've studied quantum physics now for about, we'd say probably 8 years. And I've run into a few theories, and I'm trying to figure out exactly which way I should lean with the theory that I'm looking into. And I've been told that there is no space and time. So I'd like to know what his studies have discovered as far as that's concerned.
Dr. Greene, we've only got 15 minutes. Defining space and time in that limited amount of time. But Jesus, thanks for the call. What do you think?
Well, it's a great question. I do think there is such a thing as space and such a thing as time. We are all immersed in space, and we all recognize that time is relentlessly moving forward. But what we've learned in physics is that space and time, and I think this is what the caller was driving at, may not be fundamental. Space and time themselves may be made of something finer, much like when we look at an apple, you know that it's made of molecules and atoms and subatomic particles. Space and time themselves may also be made of atoms. We haven't yet figured out what those atoms would be. They're not the ordinary atoms making up matter. We're struggling to figure out what those ingredients would be. And to me, that's where the next revolution in physics will come from, when we finally identify the ingredients making up space and time themselves.
Hmm. Jesus, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is the number. 801-355-8255. We're speaking with Dr. Brian Greene, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. You probably know him from his Nova TV specials, also his books, The Elegant Universe, The Fabric of the Cosmos, and his latest, The Hidden Reality. He's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Kingsbury Hall, and we've got a few tickets to give away for KCPW listeners. You can check our website, kcpw.org. cpw.org on how to get a hand on a couple of those. Dr. Green, you began your career trying to solve the problem that Albert Einstein could not, sort of reconciling relativity with electromagnetism. Why is this such a puzzle for physicists?
Well, we've actually gone even further than Einstein dreamed of. So he, as you said, did want to put together the two major theories of his time, which were the theories of relativity and the theory of electromagnetism. We now have an even bigger ambition. We want to put together relativity with all the forces at work in the universe, electromagnetism and the nuclear forces as well, all in one quantum package. Now, Einstein didn't succeed in his more limited quest. We don't know if we will succeed in our more ambitious quest, but we do have an approach finally on the table. It's called string theory. We don't know if it's right or wrong, but we are working out the mathematics of this theory, trying to make predictions that we might one day be able to test. We have not been able to test it yet, but it may be the dream that he had to have a single overarching theory that could describe the big things, the small things, everything in between, one mathematical tapestry that weaves everything together. That would be a thrilling moment, I think, in our species to have that deep level of understanding.
Can you briefly describe for us non-science majors what string theory is?
Well, it's a pretty straightforward theory to describe. A moment ago, I mentioned apples, and if you look inside them, even molecules and atoms, I could keep on going. We all know that atoms are not the end of the line. They are made of smaller things. You have electrons going around a nucleus, and you learn in high school that the nucleus itself has particles inside it, neutrons and protons. Even those have particles inside them called quarks. It's sort of like a sequence of Russian dolls, something finer inside of every particle that you examine. The idea of string theory is that there's one more layer to the story that we have not yet discussed. Inside any particle is a little tiny filament. It looks like a little piece of string. And the little string in every particle can vibrate in a different pattern. Now, when a violin string vibrates in a different pattern, you hear it as a different musical note. When these little strings vibrate in different patterns, they appear as different particles. So all the different particles are just the different vibrations of this new hypothetical entity. So everything comes from the music, if you will, of these vibrating strings. That's the core idea of the theory.
Now, these strings are so tiny. You can't see them with current technology. Do you have hope that technology will eventually catch up with, wanting to see this?
I hope so. The only way that you can believe any of these mathematical ideas is when they make contact with experiment and observation. No matter how beautiful, how elegant the equations might be, until they make predictions that you verify, you just don't know. And we are working hard to try to find indirect tests, because as you say, the strings are likely too small to be seen directly. Not impossible, but likely too small. So we're trying to find alternative routes that might give us some experimental handle on whether these ideas are correct. And the big machine in Geneva, the Large Hadron Collider that you perhaps have heard of, there's at least an outside hope that some of these indirect signals might be found there. I'm not holding my breath, but it's possible.
Speaking with Dr. Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, speaking tonight as part of the Nature of Things lecture series being held at 7 o'clock at Kingsbury Hall. 801-355-TALK if you'd like to join our conversation. 801-355-8255. And David is joining us from Salt Lake City. David, hi.
Hi. I'm fascinated by that whole harmonic string theory thing you just talked about. My question was about their recent, I'm not sure if to call it a discovery, but they were tracking the speed of neutrino, and they were saying that perhaps there were some of their readings were getting backwards, that the neutrino were traveling faster than the speed of light. And I wondered what information you might have about those recent experiments and what you thought about that.
This is the collider that you were just mentioning, Dr. Green.
Yes, you're right. There were some experiments announced a couple months ago where these little particles called neutrinos were traveling from Geneva, Switzerland, through the Earth's crust to a detector in Italy, Gran Sasso, Italy, and arriving there 60 nanoseconds earlier than it would have taken a beam of light to travel the same distance. And nothing is supposed to go faster than the speed of light. So what in the world is going on? Well, most of us physicists, when we heard this result, said it can't be right. there's got to be something wrong with the experiment. And many people tried to suggest where they might have gone wrong. Others said, look, maybe it is right. Let's see what the implications would be. And they wrote various papers, interesting hypothetical papers. But the bottom line is there's now new word from the experimenters that a faulty fiber optic cable may be responsible for mistiming the neutrinos. No one is certain for sure. They're going to check on it now in great detail. But my guess now is exactly what my guess was a few months ago. These results, however appealing they might be to blow a hole in Einstein's ideas, they're not going to stand up to further scrutiny. Neutrinos are not going to be found to travel faster than the speed of light.
Speed of light conquers all.
Apparently so.
David, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess I was hoping they were faster, but I think you're probably right.
David, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We're talking about physics with Dr. Brian Green from Columbia University, a speaker tonight at the Nature of Things lecture at Kingsbury Hall. 801-355-TALK is the number. Another idea that physicists are kicking around is this idea that there's more than one universe. And I think most of us have been thinking, the universe means everything. How can there be more of everything? Maybe you can describe what a multiverse is.
Well, yes, it partly is a question of language, because most of us do think that the word universe, as you say, means everything. But what we have found over the last few decades, and most importantly in the last 5 years, is that there's reason to suspect that what we have long thought to be everything may be a tiny part of a much grander cosmos. And the name that we give to that grander cosmos is multiverse, because the theories predict that there should be various realms inside this wider reality, which would be rightly called universes of their own, much like ours. So this is the idea that we are pursuing. It is completely speculative at the moment, but there are reasons to believe in it from cosmological theory, from string theory, from observations that, in fact, this year won the Nobel Prize in Physics of something called dark energy. From a variety of different perspectives, we've been led to seriously consider that our universe may be part of a complex of universes, with our universe being sort of like one expanding bubble in a big cosmic bubble bath of universes.
So does that mean that there's more than one of you speaking to my alter ego in a different alternative universe?
It starts to sound like science fiction, but actually what you say is likely to be true if these multiverse proposals themselves are correct, because you can establish mathematically without a lot of work that if there are these other universes and if there are enough of them, and the math basically shows that if there are any, there are probably infinitely many, then there simply aren't enough different arrangement of particles to populate all these universes without getting some duplicates, some repeats. So indeed, we would be having this conversation out there in this wider cosmos. And in fact, in some of those universes, I would be the radio host and you would be the physicist. Our roles might be reversed. Anything compatible with the laws of physics, in principle, could happen in these other realms.
In some ways, though, I mean, that idea seems to blur with what we think of as philosophy, with defining what reality is. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I was sitting in the green room when you said that we're now going to switch from philosophy to physics. And I said, well, they're not actually all that different. Mm-hmm. Because indeed, when we are investigating physics, the kind of physics that we're talking about here, unified theories and string theory and cosmology, these areas of science speak to the basic nature of reality. And when we find that perhaps there are other realms where there'd be copies of us, well, that does shatter various conceptions of how reality is configured. To me, it's exciting and invigorating to recognize that what we see in the world around us may be a pale reflection of a much richer, much grander reality that's out there.
Mm. Talk to me about this dark energy that you mentioned. What is that?
Well,
what do we know about it?
Dark energy rose to prominence by some observations of two teams of astronomers in the 1990s. What they were doing was they were measuring how fast the universe is expanding. So we do know that space is stretching, it's expanding, but everybody thought the expansion would slow down because, look, when you throw anything up, gravity pulls it back. So the thought was it's expanding, but gravity should be pulling it back, slowing it down. These astronomers found that the expansion is speeding up. And that's a shock. That's like throwing an apple up and it goes up faster and faster. So the question is, what's pushing on things to make it expand faster? And the answer seems to be an energy suffusing space uniformly, like sort of like a mist. We call it dark energy because it doesn't give off light. Mm. And it turns out that this energy yields repulsive gravity, not attractive gravity, anti-gravity, negative gravity. And this repulsive push, we believe, it's what's driving the expansion to speed up over time.
Wow. When we speak of theories, we think of black holes. I can't remember which of the programs I was watching of yours or which book I read it in, but the idea of the black hole is that something goes in and it doesn't come out. But you say physicists are discovering some new two-dimensional aspects to a black hole, which I found completely fascinating and a little mind-blowing, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm thinking about discussing that tonight, actually at the lecture tonight, which is this remarkable idea that everything we see in the world around us may be a kind of holographic projection of a more fundamental reality that exists on a two-dimensional surface that surrounds us. You know, when you have a real hologram in everyday life, it's a piece of plastic. It's thin, you illuminate it correctly, and it yields a realistic three-dimensional image, even though the plastic is flat, two-dimensional. Well, the studies of black holes have led us to conclude that maybe a similar thing is happening to reality, that there's in some sense a giant thin surface surrounding us, and on that surface there is information, and that information actually encodes everything that we see in the world around us. So in some sense, that information is the puppeteer pulling the strings, and we are the puppets.
That's a very
crazy idea.
Crazy
it's so crazy
idea.
That physicists are still struggling really to come to grips with it. But the one thing I want to stress is these are not wild flights of fancy that come from deranged physicists. These are ideas that emerge from decades of careful, observational, and theoretical study of the universe around us. And we allow the math to take us where it leads. We allow the observations to winnow out those ideas that are irrelevant. And these are some of the places that the investigations have so far taken us.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. He's delivering the keynote lecture in the Nature of Things series titled Why Science Matters. That's happening tonight at 7. Again, we have a limited number of free tickets for KCPW listeners. And if you want some, you can give Susan a call here at the station, 801-359-5279. Extension 224. If you want to join our conversation in the moments that we have left with Dr. Green, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Briefly, can you talk about what physicists are finding out about time and the nature of time?
Time is the big mystery. We have learned from Einstein many years ago that time has features that you wouldn't expect based on experience. If you and I synchronize our watches, Einstein established and experiments have confirmed that if you then run around the room and come back, our watches will no longer agree, not because you rattled your watch in some way, but because time does not flow at the same rate for you as it does for me if we are moving relative to each other. We've also learned that the word that I just used, the flow of time, may actually be relevant to describe human experience of time, but it's likely to be the case that time doesn't flow in any fundamental physical sense. Time may be more like space. It's just all out there, every moment in time out there, and our minds impose a certain sequence to those moments that unfolds in a way that feels like time is flowing from moment to moment to moment, but it actually isn't. But the deep question is, where does time come from? Is it made of something finer? Those are the questions that we are still struggling to answer.
Hmm. You know, I read your books. I watch the Nova specials. I really come away thinking, gosh, I am stuck in Newtonian, that mentality of what reality is. And I guess this gets back to the question that you are speaking about tonight, why science matters. How do you answer that?
Well, you are stuck in a Newtonian perspective largely because you evolved to survive. And Newtonian physics is what you need to survive. When you see that antelope running across the savanna to figure out where to throw your bow and arrow, I'm sure I'm mixing time periods here, but in order to figure out where to throw your bow and arrow, you use Newtonian physics, and that's all you need to get your next meal. But we've gone beyond mere survival, and now we're trying to plumb the depths of reality, and that does require that we step outside of Newtonian thinking. And science matters because it changes the way we engage with the universe.
Dr. Brian Green, he's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, speaking tonight, giving the keynote lecture in the Nature of Things series titled Why Science Matters, tonight at 7 o'clock at Kingsbury Hall. And again, we have a limited number of free tickets for KCPW listeners. You can give us a call here at the station, 801-359-5279, if you'd like to join us. And Dr. Green, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Next time, the Marriott Library at the University of Utah is getting a new collection of Edward Abbey writings. We'll talk about the author and about his work on the show tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.